Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today on this New Year's Day, we will examine both our foreign policy looking back to 2013 and ahead to 2014, and we'll look at our domestic policy over the past turbulent year and into this election year of 2014 just beginning. The author of a new book on the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and a comparative history of the inner politics of the U.S. and Soviet Russia, Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Johnson and Nixon, joins us to analyze the events of last year and the global landscape ahead, from Russia to China, the Middle East to Europe, and Brazil to Africa. We will assess our foreign policy, past and future, in a world of rising and falling powers, with much of the First World moving from democracy to oligarchy, and the Second and Third Worlds beset by criminal leadership as global inequality increases and ecological plunder continues. Then we will look into the domestic political arena with Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas and the author of Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. We will discuss divisions within the Republican Party with the influence of the Tea Party receding as the GOP enters an election year carrying the baggage from the destructive antics of the far right in 2013. And we will also explore emerging divisions in the Democratic Party between the corporate wing and the economic populists who want to campaign against the nation's growing income inequality, while the more business-friendly centrists are concerned about a repeat of the McGovern, Mondale, Dukakis and Kerry disasters that caution them to want to be more like the Republicans. Joining us now on this New Year's holiday is Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His new book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia, based on thousands of previously secret documents. And he's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And in terms of looking back at our foreign policy in 2013 and looking forward to, not looking forward, but looking ahead to 2014, since you're working on the comparative politics of the U.S. and Soviet Russia, it does seem that in the form of Vladimir Putin, Soviet Russia has come back. He doesn't seem to be a leader that's capable of advancing Russia, and he seems more obsessed with diminishing the United States. He's throwing a party for himself at Sochi with the Winter Olympics, and he's done some cosmetic, magnanimous gestures, releasing political prisoners. Do you think that this kind of gangster regime that he has running there is ever going to run out of rope? And that's not to suggest that our regime in the United States, they're certainly not gangsters, but they are oligarchs that run this country. So we're not necessarily holier than thou in that regard. But it does seem to me that this is so much of the world is beset by criminality in terms of leadership, and particularly in the Third World. So is there any sense to your mind that we can ever get to a regime where there is a real international court of justice and we simply won't have leaders who are criminals?
Not anytime soon, I must say, not to be too pessimistic about it, but I think that Putin obviously represents more than just his own personal dictatorship. It's a fairly layered and now much more sophisticated regime. As you pointed out, his public relations have become much more adept than they were, and he is indeed throwing a party for himself. I think it's clear that they will probably emerge from Sochi if nothing awful happens, with even more prestige. And he is, after all, flexing his muscles in a number of ways internationally. The intervention with Syria and the deal that's been cut, we can only hope will succeed up to a point on chemical and biological weapons, will undoubtedly add to his prestige and his power in the future. But we have to remember, Ian, always, of course, that this is a superpower despite its problems, its difficulties, its its period of poverty and eclipse after the fall of the Soviet Union. It remains a very formidable force in economic terms as well as military terms, and of course has its own geopolitical ambitions. So I love your comparison of the two states, one man's gangster, another man's oligarch, another man's statesman. They do have a great deal in common. They always did. The title of my book is Kindred Rivals. They were kinsmen in a number of ways.
Well, let's turn to the emerging power, which is China, still considerably behind the U.S. if you measure GDP. And, of course, with the U.S. number one, China number two, and then I think Russia's around 14 by comparison. But let's turn to the pivot towards China, which seems to be more of a pivot against China. The whole Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement is really ganging up on China, and it seems that the U.S. policy there is to, and it's, of course, it's fed by China's, you know, intimidation of other of its neighbors over these islands, etc. So it seems to be that we're organizing the neighborhood against China. Is that the way you see it?
Absolutely. I think that this is a policy driven by rather traditional sort of geopolitical calculations in the Pentagon, much more so, I think, than the Department of State or the White House. And I think this is one of the many surrenders that Obama made on coming into office. The pivot, of course, is insurance for the military industrial complex in a number of ways, and it does reassure some nervous allies. I think the Japanese and to some extent other powers on the Pacific Rim are uncomfortable. This is an enormous economic power, as you well know, but I think at the same time there's a paradox here. I think that economic power, while it flexes its muscles in a number of ways, a force, after all, in American life, in real estate, in investment, and all the rest, all of that bullion, this enormous mountain of it that they hold, is still potentially its greatest weakness, because what's happening inside China, and we know relatively little about that in terms of what the American media actually covers, is, I think, an inherently destabilizing factor. The princelings that control that party will have, I think, their hands full in terms of this emerging middle class and all of the political aspirations, which are bound, if not in the short run, in the long run, to follow all of this prosperity. And then on top of that, of course, there's the sheer environmental and ecological disaster that China represents in so many ways. Coming online with a society that mass of that sheer weight in terms of industrial pollution and the automobile and all the rest is going to be quite a revolutionary factor in the 21st century.
Again, I'm speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His new book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia, based on thousands of previously secret documents. And he's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. Let's turn to your new book, Between the Graves. And, of course, Afghanistan is the graveyard of empires, and the United States is the latest empire to volunteer to join that folly, along with the British and the Russians. And we have this extraordinary situation now where this criminal leader, this narco-kleptocracy led by Karzai and his family, he's actually extorting the United States that won't sign the agreement because he wants to make sure his brother or somebody will succeed him. So he says he'll sign the agreement after the elections. I mean, it's all so flagrant. How do we get suckered? I mean, you resigned during the Vietnam War because there we were propping up another narco dictatorship too. I mean, why do we pick these losers?
Well, in the book, I compare Vietnam and Afghanistan in a number of ways. And I must say, back to your remark about graveyard of empires, of course, it's the graveyard mostly of Afghans, because they're the ones, the people of that country, in that tragic history over the last half century, have paid the awful price of interventions from all sides. What it has in common, of course, with Vietnam is the utter ignorance and distraction of the American government. We didn't know much about what we were doing in Southeast Asia, and we know perhaps even less about what we're doing in the Hindu Kush. The Afghans are behaving, as you pointed out, very much in character. This is a kleptocracy. It is, of course, descended from the warlord regimes that were there, overthrown by the Taliban. The Taliban are morphing right in front of our eyes into something else. It's a recipe for utter tragedy and disaster. And the United States will, of course, again, because of the surrender of this administration, and I'm sure whoever its successor is as well, to the Pentagon and to the forces that drive American foreign policy, will be there in some presence. Well beyond what we should be. 2014, of course, is an artificial withdrawal date in the sense that American instructors and advisors and surely covert contract combat forces will be on the ground in that country for a long time to come. No one wants to see on the evening network news, on cable news, or on the front page of the New York Times, the kind of horrible pictures that will be there if the Taliban takes power and if all of the reckonings that have been accumulated over the last two decades are exacted on Kabul and the country at large. But Ian, I think it's important to remember that this is not the Afghanistan of the history books. It's not even the Afghanistan that it was when the Americans first dropped in, as it were. The first CIA teams came in the autumn of 2001. It is a country in rapid and in some respects dizzying change. It has been impacted by the millions that have been poured in, albeit most of that money corrupted and wasted. The Afghans are still brutally poor, and half their kids have no school. Half of them have no medical care. It's one of the great tragedies and disgraces of American foreign policy. But the country is changing. I think, again, the irony here is that it's going to be as a result of those changes, many of which are positive in the status of women and the education of both little boys and little girls. It's going to be an even more violent place in the next 10 to 15 or 20 years, I think, than it has been in the past. And whether it becomes the graveyard of many more Americans or not, of course, will be up to what happens here in the political process and how sophisticated we are. But back to your earlier theme about Putin, we must always remember that Russia is still, though they're relatively invisible and quiet in that part of the world, still an actor, still an interested power. And we know that they have they've been very aggressive in the Caucasus, after all, and they have aggressive relations with some Central Asian states, with the successor states to the old Soviet Union. The Russians will play a role in the future of Afghanistan as well, and there is always the omnipresent power in the region, the Pakistanis. Speaking of kleptocracies, a nuclear-armed one will be in fact the decisive factor in the history of Afghanistan.
Well, Roger Morris, let's take a brief station break, and we'll get back on this New Year's date, continuing the conversation about looking back at U.S. foreign policy in 2013 and looking ahead to 2014. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and we're continuing the conversation here on this New Year's Day with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His new book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. He's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. So in terms of the Middle East, where it seems that thanks to Bush, Cheney, Rice, and Rumsfeld, we are to some extent a spent power. We wasted all those lives and treasures, mostly Iraqis, of course, on that foolhardy invasion and occupation and then the withdrawal. We're leaving behind a broken state that's still divided and likely to explode again. And, of course, the only winner of that war has been Iran. But curiously enough, it seems like there may well be a big strategic shift underway where the duplicitous Saudis have been absolutely taking us to the cleaners for the longest time, promoting the most toxic form of Islam around the world, along with radicalism. And they're behind the al-Nusra people who are going to try and turn Syria into the Somalia on the Mediterranean. And at the same time, they're radicalizing so much of Africa and around the world and Pakistan that you just mentioned. They've been our allies for the longest time. It's about time we woke up, at least to my mind. Surely, you know, maybe we've backed the wrong horse. Do you think there will be a change and we'll pivot towards Iran and away from Saudi Arabia?
Well, I'm not sure about pivoting. I do think there are some very positive signs. I think obviously the Geneva initial agreement sets the stage for something meaningful. I do think that Obama would like to leave this legacy if he possibly could. The problem with pivots, as you know, Ian, and longer-term changes of the kind you were discussing is that it will go beyond the life of this administration. So it, again, depends upon imponderable factors that we would find it hard to predict here, whether it's Hillary Clinton or perhaps Governor Christie or one of these specimens from American politics. The Iranian chemistry here is very plain. They've been hurt to some extent by the sanctions. They do have, like the Chinese, as we pointed out, a restive and growing and young population that's very impatient with the restraints and with the deprivation of the past. That's all on the side of change and good. I do think that it depends again on how open and how honest the West is in all of this, whether we will be reasonable in the kinds of restraints and inspection requirements that we impose. And we mustn't forget, of course, the very, very powerful force of the Israel lobby, which will be opposed to almost anything that the administration does, and there'll be a showdown here in Washington in American politics. I think every bit as dramatic as important as anything with Iran. But this is, as you say, as you said of Putin, this is a policy and a course in the Middle East at large. With the corruption of the Saudis and this unbelievable crime that we committed in Iraq, a policy which has run out of all its steam and all its rationale. There's going to be a change in the array of actors in the Middle East. Whatever we do, the Syrian mess strikes me as deeply depressing on all sides. I think it's no joke to say a Somalia and the Levant. I mean, I think that these forces are extraordinarily dangerous. On the other hand, I think there is a mutual exhaustion which could lead very quickly, more quickly than we may assume, maybe in 2014, looking ahead here, to some kind of sit down, some kind of negotiated settlement, which I think will leave, of course, much of the Assad regime in power, will leave a kind of status quo and could lead to a partition of Syria. But that's something, again, awfully hard to predict because of the stake of the Israelis and the Saudis, all the actors in the region. But all of these ripple effects are felt everywhere, certainly in by Hezbollah and by Hamas, and not least in a country that we have somewhat ignored here in all the turmoil of the last several months, and that's Egypt, which is back apparently in the grip of a very reactionary and violent military regime, beginning to kill its own people with something of the same regularity that Mubarak practiced. This is by no means, it may be a new Middle East. It's not a more peaceful Middle East. It's not a Middle East that the United States would prefer, I think, if we had a more enlightened view of our own interests. And it's not a Middle East where we have much power or authority to do anything. So I think that we're going to have to, as Melton says, they also serve who only stand and wait. We're going to have to stand and wait to a very large extent.
And, of course, Roger Morris, we've left Europe to last here. South America and the BRICS, of course, deserves attention, although South America, Brazil is having some reversals, and it will, of course, host the World Cup. And it has some of the worst polarity in terms of income inequality, which, of course, is growing apace here in the United States. Let's just touch on Europe. I guess the main headlines lately have been how the Europeans are annoyed at the National Security Agency following Edward Snowden's leaks. But most of those seem to be to do with a change in American intelligence, where the National Security Agency and intelligence itself has been privatized to the extent where so much of what they appear to be doing is economic espionage. And I think that's a subtext, at least for the lot of the European anger. What's your sense?
Well, it's always been, Ian, as you know, a troubled marriage. We have philandered in that relationship in a number of ways. We've spied on them for years. This is hardly anything new. It happened during my period in government. It's been happening for decades. And the Europeans, of course, are still very tightly entwined with us. I think it's indicative of that we have this conflict in the streets now in Ukraine, with the tug of war between Russia and the Euros and the West for this former, after all, former conquest and province of the old Soviet Union. Europe, I think, still sees itself as potentially an independent actor, and it may well flex its muscles again in important ways in the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations and in the Middle East, in Syria, but there is still an American ward in a number of ways economically, and I think it would be healthy for everyone if they had a more independent more independent of American foreign policy, in which they did make their own deals with the Chinese and to some extent with the new Russia, but that makes for more complications as well. I don't see any basic change in the current American relationship with either Europe or with Latin America. These are things that are on hold given all of the turmoil and all of the roiling change in the rest of the world. I mean, we have our hands full dealing with the residue of our disaster in the Middle East. We certainly have begun to embark on a more militant rivalry with the Chinese in East Asia, and I think Europe will be a sideshow for the foreseeable future.
And we're sort of doing a full circle here because you mentioned the Ukraine, and of course we started out with Putin, and Yanukovych in Ukraine and his son are just stealing the country blind, unlike Putin, who regulates the oligarchs and takes a fee. Yanukovych's oldest son is saying to the oligarchs in Ukraine, now I'm your 50% partner. And the public are disgusted. But that goes back to the original observation that so much of the world is led. The world's leaders are absolute criminals. I mean, not just...
Well, absolutely. And that's what you were saying, unrest in Brazil. I think it turns out, of course, that the neoliberal order, the globalism that we were celebrating in the 80s and 90s, turns out to be simply a rather rancid form of an older tyranny, older oligarchies, and new faces, but the same old plunder. And that's something the United States, of course, is going to have to come to terms with inside its own political and economic system. And until we do, I can't see any foreign policy that will ever address any of that abroad.
Well, Roger Morris, I thank you so much for joining us here on this New Year's for an overview of foreign policy, both in 2013 and ahead of us in 2014.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His new book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. He's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back on this New Year's Day, looking ahead to 2014 and back to 2013 in terms of the domestic policy landscape.